Folks, this is The Weird Part, and I am your host, Vincent Trewell. Tonight is going to be a solo episode, but it may be a little longer than the average solo episode. So anyway, this evening's episode, number 62, I titled Lost and Found. I will be discussing the topic of lost persons, people who have gone missing. Now, frequently that ends with them being found dead. Those cases, especially when unsolved, can be interesting, and of course should always be treated with sincere sympathy for the victims. But those aren't the cases that really interest me. The ones that I really like are where the person goes missing and then is found alive years later. I find that absolutely fascinating. This is more of a true crime episode than a paranormal episode, though there is copious crossover, as we will discuss. So I think this will be an enjoyable one. I think people will like this. I certainly am going to find it interesting, so let's get started. Under different circumstances, it will mostly be that, not exclusively. We have plenty of exceptions and plenty of interesting things, and I think everybody's going to like this. I certainly hope so. But yeah, it's mostly about, it's what I call lost and found. People have gone missing, and then an indeterminate time later, we're found to be alive and sometimes completely well, sometimes not so much. All the time, definitely not dead. There will be a few exceptions to that, and there will be some commentary on how the true crime community views these type of things, and there will be some talk about the paranormal. So I think this will be a nice episode. As far as solo episodes go, it probably is going to run a little bit longer than usual, but I think that'll be a good thing. So let's get started. Oh, I have to give a caveat. These cases will not be presented in chronological order. They'll be presented in the order in which I researched them and became aware of them. Just kind of how it goes. But they're all interesting. Hell, I find them all fascinating. So bear with me, please. So I'd like to start with... This comes from October 27, 2017, CBS News. Lowell, Massachusetts. 42 years after disappearance, New York woman found alive in Massachusetts. That's the headline. A woman who disappeared from upstate New York, I'm quoting this directly from the printout of the news story, disappeared from upstate New York after being dropped off for a doctor's appointment 42 years ago. So going back to 2017, that would have been, quick, somebody do the math, 1965? Yes. The sheriff's office in Sullivan County, New York, said Flora Stevens, 78, was using the last name Harris when detectives tracked her down this week in the residence of Lowell near Boston. Officials said they'd been unable to figure out details of what happened to her between the time she disappeared in August 1975, I stand corrected, and when she was finally found. Technology has changed so much and research so much so fast, Detective Rich Morgan of the Sullivan County Sheriff's Office told CBS Boston. He said Stevens was an employee of the Catskills Resort when her husband dropped her off for a doctor's appointment at a hospital in Monticello, 75 miles northwest of New York City. When he returned to pick her up, she wasn't there. And so she was only gone for 42 years. That was me commentating. Detectives got a break in September thanks to a query from New York State police investigator working on a different cold case. The unidentified remains of a woman had been found in neighboring Orange County, and investigators said they roughly matched Stephen's general characteristics. State police investigators asked Sullivan County for help, tracking down any relatives who could provide a DNA sample for possible identification. During a record search, Morgan discovered someone was using Stephen's social security number at an assisted living facility in Lowell, Massachusetts. New York detectives traveled to Lowell this week to meet Stevens, who was using the name Flora Harris. According to CBS Boston, authorities showed Stevens an old photo when she was 36 years old. He says, "That's me." "Or me," she responded with one word, "me," said Martin. Stevens, who has dementia, could not share her story. "Same first name, different last name, but same birth date and social security," said Martin. We really don't know the circumstances of why or how she disappeared. She had psychiatric problems leading up to that point. Her medical records under her new name shows that she was living in nursing homes in New Hampshire and New York City before arriving in Lowell in 2001, police said. Stephen's husband died in 1985, and apparently she has no living relatives, officials said. Now, okay, that's quote unquote. I've stopped quoting now, but I can tell you, as an attorney, everybody has living relatives. Even if you are a single childless orphan, you have a third cousin, okay? As I was taught, there's always an heir, okay? So we'll just leave it hanging there, but yes. Now, for some reason, in 1975, she went to a apparently routine doctor's appointment and then disappeared for the next 42 years. These things happen. Many in the true crime community seem to want everybody who's missing for a week to be dead, but that's not always what happens. When I say they want that, it's not a vicious thing, but there just seems to be a rather morbid obsession with everybody who's missing is dead. And I can 1,000% say that everyone who's missing is not dead. I'll stand by that truth. Now, sometimes, I don't know whether she was intentional or unintentional, but sometimes it's completely intentional, which brings me to my next case. Mr. Richard Hoagland, and let me make this completely clear, we're not talking about the Richard Hoagland who's on Art Bell and talks about the face on Mars, whom I love, but that's neither here nor there. Another guy happened to be named Richard Hoagland. So this comes from ABC News, October 27, 2016. In 1993, Mr. Hoagland told his wife that he was going to the hospital and was never seen again. Well, for a while, you know. Linda, and I hope I don't measure her last name, Iser, Hoagland's wife at the time of his disappearance, told ABC News 2020, "How do you walk away from your old children, from your own children? How do you turn your back?" Isler and Hoagland had an idyllic life in Indianapolis. After an earlier divorce, Hoagland, now I'm quoting from the ABC News piece, Hoagland thought he had found love again with Isler. And they show a photo where they seem very much happy with each other. He was very spontaneous. He was a shaker and a roller. He was always making deals and doing things. He was very successful, Isler said. He was a lot of fun to be with. The family had a big house, a steady income, and exotic vacations. But their picture-perfect relationship came to an end one day in 1993 after 11 years of marriage. He called me at work and told me that he was ill and he needed to go to the emergency room, I still recalled. And I said, "Well, why don't you just wait and I'll go with you?" He said, "No, I don't have time to wait." Geisler said she called the hospital in the area, but there was no trace of him ever being there, although it had vanished. His toothbrush was still there. He didn't pack any clothes. It was cold. It was February. He didn't even take a coat. Ogden hadn't even taken his passport, Geisler said. Her son Matthew was 9 years old at the time, and his brother was 6 years old at the time. Initially, you think, okay, this won't last long. He'll be back. Matthew Hoagland, his son, told 2020. Authorities eventually found Richard Hoagland's car abandoned in Indianapolis International Airport. But there was no record of Richard Hoagland taking any flights out of the airport the day he went missing, Geisler said. That summer, his two sons both received a birthday card from their father, each containing $50. Doug's card said, "Maybe someday we'll get to see each other. I bet I won't even know you. It has been so long. Mind your mother. Bye, Dad." Those words were the last they ever heard from Hoagland, and Geisler said police viewed her as a suspect in the disappearance. Stop quote. Yeah, that happens a lot. When somebody's spouse disappears, I can't stress this enough. The other spouse becomes an automatic suspect. And some armchair attorneys on the internet will tell you to lawyer up immediately. And I can say, and I'm not giving legal advice, but I am just using common sense, don't do that. If your loved one goes missing, you need to cooperate at least until you're actually accused of anything. If you lawyer up instantly, you've just become prime and only suspect. I just need to say that because so many people say, oh, I'd lawyer up instantly. All I'd say is lawyer. Really? So if your spouse or child went missing, all you'd do is ask for a lawyer? At that point, you don't know that they're not alive. Shouldn't you be helping? How is that going to look, honestly, to the police? Or anybody else, okay? You know, don't do that. Now, if they start accusing you of crimes you didn't commit, obviously, then you should lawyer up. But as common sense would have it, look right into the camera and say, I did not break the law. I did not do anything wrong. I was not involved in this in any way. I am being wrongly accused. And then lawyer up. After you've answered all the relevant questions. That's, to me, just common sense. If a loved one close to you disappears, and the first thing you do is lawyer up, I mean, that looks terrible, okay? Even if you had nothing to do with anything, which is sometimes the case. But you hear that, especially on Reddit, of all places. Don't take legal advice from Reddit. Don't take any advice from Reddit while we're on it. But, yeah, let's go back to the case at hand. Hoagland's wife was considered a suspect. As she says, and I'm going back to quoting, they interrogated me over and over and over. They alluded a lot to the possibility that he was involved in some sort of drug trafficking, which I had no clue, Geisler said. Geisler said they lost the house and cars after he vanished. Her mother stepped in to help. He devastated us. He left us with nothing, absolutely nothing. I was very broken, she said. After 10 years, Hoagland was declared dead. Geisler eventually moved on and remarried. Then, just this last summer, which would be, you know, quite a few years ago here, Geisler received a voicemail from Detective Anthony Cardillo of the Pasco County Sheriff's Department in Florida. He asked me if I knew who Richard Hoagland was. I said, yes, that's my ex-husband, Geisler said. He said, we have him in custody. It turns out, police said, he had been living as a man named Terry Shamansky, who was a fisherman killed in a boating accident in 1991. After he disappeared in 1993, police said Hoagland had fled to Florida, where he rented a room from Shamansky's father. Hogan found Szymanski's death certificate and stole it, police said. Using that death certificate, he applies for a birth certificate. He uses the birth certificate to a driver's license. Once he has that driver's license, he starts establishing his name as Terry Szymanski. Treadwell told 2020. I have to just interject here, folks. Don't try this at home. These things used to be way more possible in the 20th century than they are in the 21st. Especially now, you're tracked in so many ways that don't consider this a plan. This is a cautionary tale. Anyway, moving right along. Going back to the ABC News story. According to Cardello, Hoagland bought a home in Zimfalls, Florida, and married a woman named Mary. The two even had a child together. He said there were always questions, but it always come up with a reason or an explanation, Cardello said. Hoagland might have gotten away with living under his new identity. However, this past summer, the real Terry Szymanski's family started looking into their family history using Ancestry.com for a genealogy project. And there we go. Added that last part. Through his research, the real Szymanski's nephew discovered that his uncle, who supposedly died in 1991, had gotten married 2 years after they buried him. After the Szymanski family contacted police, Cardillo interviewed Hoagland. He told me his name was Terry Szymanski, provided me a driver's license. Terry Szymanski, correct date of birth, everything, Cardillo recalled. I asked him again. He told me his name was Terry Szymanski. Eventually, I showed him the death certificate they had brought with me. He eventually told me his real name was Richard Hoagland. Cardillo said Hoagland's unsuspecting new wife and son were blindsided by the revelation. Obviously, their 20 years of marriage was shattered, Cardillo said. Their son came down. He was shocked. It was still his father. It's his blood, but the Szymanski name is not his. The emotions they were feeling were between anger and sadness and wonder of why. Cardillo said Hoagland's only explanation for disappearing was family issues with his wife and children. I believe he got caught up with the wrong people, but carried away and over his head in something, Matthew Hoagland said. Richard Hoagland is now in jail, and this is from several years ago. But, awaiting trial and charges include identity fraud. He pleaded not guilty of the charges and was unavailable for an interview with 2020. I have this ring. It's my dad's ring. That's it. I do wear it for the most part every day. But I think I wear it to remind me of a bad example, said Michael Hoagland. And so, yes, that was one example of this phenomena of people just choosing to take off and start a new life and not giving their family the courtesy of a phone call or postcard to say, yeah, that's what's happening. I'm not dead. I'm not, hostage. But people do that in this world. And as I'm just trying to kind of make clear, everybody who's missing is not dead. Let me just pause for a moment. This next one is kind of the one that put me onto this whole thing, which I knew existed before, but really made it fascinating. And this comes from a 2013 CNN article about a woman named Brenda Heist, H-E-I-S-T, just like the robbery, ironically. Anyway, she disappeared from Pennsylvania in 2002 and was found in Florida in 2013. And, let's go from there. The tale of Brenda Heist, I'm quoting from CNN 2013, the tale of Brenda Heist, the Pennsylvania mother who abandoned two children only to turn up in Florida 11 years later, has taken another unlikely turn. On Saturday, she remained jailed in Santa Rosa County on a warrant for alleged violation of probation, forgery, and giving a false name to law enforcement, sent out formally a statement for the Ouachita County Sheriff's Office. Heist, who used the assumed name Kelsey Lynn Smith, is awaiting extradition, forgery told CNN affiliate WKXT. She turned herself in Friday. Heist, meanwhile, may have not spent most of those 11 years homeless, as she told police last week when she turned herself in, saying she'd abandoned her family because of stress. Sandra Forrester says she knew Heist in 2010. At that time, Heist cleaned her Florida home and went by the name Lovely Smith. She actually moved in with me about 6 months after she started cleaning the house, Forrester told CNN's Anderson Cooper 360 on Friday. Heist first came into her life through a neighbor who recommended her when Forrester was looking for a housekeeper. The neighbor had used her as a babysitter and spoke highly of her. At first, the two women shared small talk, but little more on Heist's weekly visit to clean. But over time, the conversations took a different, more personal tone. She told me she had a bad relationship with a boyfriend, and I started to feel bad for her, Forrester said. She described it as a sort of abusive situation, saying he was maybe an alcoholic, and I just let her know that my door was open for her. I felt bad for her. Forrester asked more questions about Heist's past when she moved into the house, but not a whole lot. When I did ask, she made it clear she never had kids and didn't want any. Heist also claimed to be a widow. She said she'd been married for like 20 years to a man named Lee, and he had worked for Marriott, and had traveled together and visited amazing places, and he had died, Forrester said. After she moved in, bringing some belongings with her, Heist lived with her for 10 or 11 months. She used a computer and cell phone, had a Facebook page, and was on an internet dating site. Forrester said she had friends outside of me. Heist's appearance was nothing like the worn down face shown in photos taken after she turned her in last week to authorities in Key Largo, Florida. I was absolutely shocked when I saw that photo, said. She has deteriorated significantly since the last time she was seen around here, which was, you know, the middle of 2012, the end of 2012. It's not been very long, you know, 7 months or so. Another twist in the tale is that Heist revealed her true last name to Forrester's son, with whom she had become close while living in the family home. He was around the same age as Heist's own son when she abandoned her Pennsylvania family nearly a decade ago. Forrester had taken her son aside to tell him the truth about the woman who he knew as Miss Lovely, so he wouldn't learn about her on the news. But he told her he already knew her last name was Heist. I was stunned when he knew that. For a little boy, what kind of cool last name? I said, honey, how do you know that? Miss Lovely told me. But while Heist was making friends and living an apparently normal life in Florida, the husband, son, and daughter she'd left behind in 2002 continued to wonder whether something terrible had happened to her. Police searched for her for years, at one time creating a cold case task force. Her family remained angry over the pain her disappearance caused. I don't think she deserves to see me, her 20-year-old daughter, Morgan Heist, told CNN's Piers Morgan Live on Thursday night. I really don't have any plans of going to see her. The fact that her mother, who she saw last when she was 8, never even called, has left her seething, Morgan Heist said. The anger is captured in a post on the daughter's Twitter page that reads she hopes her mother rots in hell. That makes me really mad, Morgan Heist said. I can't believe she would do that because she was a good mom. She was great. I mean, I guess something happened. Something snapped in her. Her father, Lee Heist, says he's not planning on visiting his ex-wife anytime soon. They were going through a divorce at the time she disappeared, and he was treated as a suspect at the time in her disappearance, though he was eventually cleared. Which, stop quote, let me just say, he was really fortunate to be cleared. Okay. It doesn't always go like that. And he's awfully lucky that he wasn't wrongfully convicted, because that happens. It happens a lot. And yeah, that's a thing. And if you're a spouse and your spouse disappears, well, I said before, you know, use common sense. So yes, in 2010, her then-husband, Lee Heist, had filed a petition with the county court to have Brenn declared legally deceased. According to... Excuse me, I'm just having a little bit of computer difficulties, but we're, that's what happened. To a Lewis police news release, he was seeking closure, he said. I don't see where it would do any good for either of us to see her again, Lee Heist said. He remarried and said he will learn to forgive his former wife. But for Morgan Heist, forgiving her mom may not be easy. I'm quoting from the CNN piece here now. Hope to eventually forgive her one day for myself, not for her. Here's where, unquote, here's where it gets interesting for me. This wasn't some calculatedly planned operation. Again, this is according to CNN, according to her story, but seemingly pretty verifiable. Brenda Heist vanished in February 2002 after last being seen dropping off her children at school. She was applying for housing assistance so she could get an apartment after the breakdown of her marriage. She works as a bookkeeper for a car dealer and hoped to receive some financial aid. However, her request is denied, police said. She was very upset, sitting on a park bench crying, thinking about how she would raise her children, feeling sorry for herself, said Sergeant John Schofield, a Lewisboro, Pennsylvania police detective. He's one of the many officers who searched for Heist. By her account, it wasn't long before she was approached by two men and a woman who asked her what was wrong. After she told them what happened, they invited her to hitchhike with them down to Florida. At a whim, she decided at that very moment she would go along with them, Schofield said. Schofield spoke to Heist at length after she turned herself in. She was very emotional. She hung her head. She's the same. She was crying when I met with her. She knows what she did was completely wrong. But all that while, she'd never made one effort to call her contact her family at all, Schofield said. Heist told police she spent the first 2 years homeless, living under bridges, eating food thrown out by restaurants after they closed. For the next 7 years, she lived in a camper with a man she had met. They made money as day laborers, cleaning boats and doing other jobs where she didn't have to show ID or paid in cash. After that relationship soured, Schofield said, she actually lived on the street again for another 2 years. But the revelations made by Forrester raised new questions over the truth of Heist's account. I don't think we know the full story yet, Schofield told CNN's Anderson Cooper 360 on Friday. The facts are she left. She turned her back on her family. She started a new life down in Florida. Whether she lived homeless or whether she lived a wonderful life as a live-in housekeeper, I don't think that for the 11 years, I don't think that was for the 11 years, just that was just for the last few years here. Schofield said Heist is still looking at charges for false IDs, theft and possession of drugs and drug paraphernalia in Florida. There may also be false ID and theft charges to face in Pennsylvania, he said. She had never suspected Heist of using drugs, Forrester said, or she would not have allowed her near her family. So yes, that was what happened with Brenda Heist. And very fortunately for her husband, the police actually did their job and didn't just slam him away in prison. And then she popped up alive 11 years later. And at this moment, to the best of my research, her whereabouts are still unknown. So there's that. A lot of these things are not nearly as simple as people think. And the fact that somebody can just disappear like that and go on to live a whole different life should give everyone pause and have more to say on that. Let me go next to one of the all-time greatest hits of missing people who maybe weren't exactly missing, and that's the case of Brandi Starr. And let me just spell that out, because part of the reason I noticed her case was because of the unusual spelling of her name. For those who want to Google it and get a more further information, it's Brandi spelled B-R-A-N-D-I, Starr as S-T-A-H-R. She was a Texas college student who disappeared from Texas A&M in 1998 and sent off a massive nationwide search and press explosion. Now, where I'm quoting from is OutsideTheBeltway.com, spelled just like it sounds, but this can be confirmed on any number of news sites. This is just what I found to be the most clear and concise. Missing Texas student found after 7 years, and this comes from the Associated Press. A Texas A&M University student who had been feared and murdered after disappearing nearly 7 years ago has been found alive and working in Kentucky, according to authorities. Brandi Starr went missing in October 1998, and police spent hours searching for her body in wooded areas. They questioned serial rapists and murderer about her just hours before he was executed last night. But a telephone tip led investigators to Florence, Kentucky, where Starr has been working for the last 5 years. Now, we're talking in 05, so let's take that into account. This is a while back. Quote, unquote, yeah. Has been working for the last 5 years at a Sam's Club, said Texas Ranger Frank Melnick. We thought we were dealing with a missing persons case, Melnick said. But in actuality, we were dealing with a person who did not want to be found and was in hiding. Starr, 27, hid from her family after she and her mother, Ann Dickinson, got into an argument over bad grades she received during her sophomore year, and her family stopped paying for school. For the last 5 years, Starr worked under her real name using her social security number. The police said they were unable to locate her that way because they don't have access to IRS records. Dickens and Starr haven't reacted yet, but have talked on the phone. Starr told her sister the family should not bother visiting her. But her mother said nothing will stop her. We're going, I'm going. Even if they sit out in a Sam's Club parking lot to see her, Dickinson said. Although Starr committed no crime in her disappearance, investigators spent a lot of money and time looking for her, Malinek said. The responsible thing to do would have been let somebody know you're okay, Malinek said. There are going to be people expending long hours and effort trying to find a missing person. Yes, unquote. To make this clear, she got bad grades going to college. She didn't want to go back and face her parents, so she disappeared. But she continued to use her real name and real social security number and presumably real date of birth and just go to a different state and had a legitimate job for several years. And yeah, that happens. She wasn't missing, but she totally fit the profile of someone who was missing and murdered and, you know, God knows what else. And these things happen too. And I just think it's worth noting that, you know. It's an absolutely fascinating case if you want to dip into it, because it shows something that does happen and, you know, doesn't get reported on all that much. Now, the next one I have is going to be a little darker. Oh, no, a hell of a lot darker. The rest look like they're pretty cool compared to this one. But it's still a case of a person who's reported missing who wasn't actually ever really missing. And this comes from this year, from Houston, Texas. And, well, let's just go to it. This is as reported by ABC7NY. Headline is, Houston man found after 8 years was never missing, neighbors say. Residents of a Houston neighborhood are questioning whether a 25-year-old man found alive after he was reported missing 8 years ago was really ever missing. Keisha Ross and her family were shocked this week when they heard Randolph Rudy Farias was found, saying that they never knew he was reported missing. Civil court records reveal his mother lives in the same street in Northeast Houston. He used to come in my garage, chill with my cousin, son, and daughter. Ross said that boy has never been missing. Ross's cousin, Broderick Connolly, said he and Farias would hang out often. Laughing, good times, Connolly said. Sometimes he'd go to the park by himself, Ross added. They know him as Dolph, short for his given name, Rudolph. They said he goes to their home often, but they haven't seen him in the last few weeks. According to Houston Police Department, someone called officers on Thursday morning after a man was found sleeping outside a church. That man had an item on him with a family member's identification, which is how police were able to contact Farias' mother. Police identified the man as Farias, who was first reported missing in 2015 when he was 17. His mother reported him missing after she said he never returned for a walk with his dogs. The Texas Center for Missing announced that Farias had been found over the weekend, sharing the following statement on behalf of the family. I want to thank the media and public for all their support. My son, Rudy Farias IV, was found on Tuesday, June 29th, after being missing for 8 years. Currently, we do not have any information on Rudy's case. What we do know is that at the time of recovery, a good Samaritan located him unresponsive and immediately called police and 911. My son Rudy is receiving the care he needs to overcome his trauma. But this time, he is nonverbal and not able to communicate with us. We're asking for privacy during this difficult time, but we'll share more details as Rudy continues to heal. The chief of the Houston Fire Department said Farias refused to be transported by ambulance, which his mother signed off on, and he was left to his family's care. Farias' mother shared pictures with Eyewitness News, claiming she brought her son to the hospital. She says she believed her son was beaten, abused, and thought someone kidnapped him for all those years. Another neighbor, who wishes to stay anonymous, says he's seen Farias living in his mother's home for years. I was just shocked someone was missing, and we see him, he said, shocking to everyone. At the time of Farias' disappearance, his mother told officials he suffered from depression and PTSD since his brother died in a motorcycle accident in 2011, an incident neighbors say he spoke about. He said he had lost a brother in a motorcycle accident, Ross said. I know when he was thinking about his brother, he wouldn't come to hang out. He would go and sit there in the back of the woods by himself. On Tuesday, ABC 13 attempted to speak with Farias' mother, who did not want to do an on-camera interview, but said that the man her neighbors have spent time with and seen living with her is her nephew. He showed a picture of her nephew, but neighbors insist that's not him. Now, a Houston community is trying to wrap their heads around why either of them would say he was ever missing. I do not know. That's what I've been trying to figure out all day, Ross said. I'm confused right now. I'm like, what's going on? According to the Houston Police Department, a family member called them in 2018, and Farias was living behind a relative's house. When police went to investigate, they didn't find him. Investigators have yet to speak with Farias since he was found. They're scheduled to speak with him on Wednesday. Unquote. This has been an ongoing case, and it's all weird as hell. No, I'm not going to take a position on what actually happened, because nobody's been arrested and nobody's been charged, to the best of my knowledge. But it seems very strange that he would be reported missing and apparently never be missing. But yeah, that's kind of why I brought it up. There's a lot of allegations floating around about his mother, and they're all very bad, so I'm not going to mention them here. But yes, things like that happen. Everybody who's missing isn't really missing. That's just kind of the thing I'm trying to talk about in this episode, that things are not nearly as clear-cut as people always think. And we should be a little bit more open-minded about missing persons cases. And by the way, they're not always dead. And let me segue into something with that. By which I'd like to talk about the disappearance of college student Laura Murray. And before that, let me preface this by saying I thought this would be a one episode podcast, but apparently there's going to be, just based on the data, there's going to be a part one and a part two at minimum. So please bear with me, and I hope you get something out of this. We're going to talk more on Murray in just a moment. So let's talk briefly more on Murray. I'm going to spell her name because there is so much research done there. Some good, some not so good. But this is an ongoing missing persons case where people have insanely strong opinions. This is Maura, M-A-U-R-A, M-U-R-R-A-Y, Maura Murray. She went missing in February 9, 2004, at the age of 21. Now, if you go onto Reddit, you'll find copious opinions, and people have done whole podcasts, and I mean plural, over her disappearance, and there was a, in my opinion, terrible book written about it. But yes, she's still missing. Now, I will give the caveat that I believe she is not dead, and that she is alive and well somewhere in Quebec, Canada. But that, I have to get into that later. As I said, I thought this is going to be a one-part podcast, but it's going to have to be at least two, and it may spawn into three or four. But yes, Maura Murray was a college student who went missing, and there are many, many unanswered questions. What there isn't is any physical evidence that she is deceased, okay? And yet there's a huge bias in the true crime community that she's dead. So many people seem to want to believe that she's dead, but there is nothing to prove that, and I feel that I can back that up. But unfortunately, there's so much material involved, I'm going to have to bring this up in episode two of this. So in words, anyway, thank you very much for listening. This has been the Weird Part. I'm Vincent Truro. Thank you, and good night.